Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. That is, and you will be hearing him all night, a CD called The Best of Siegel Schwall. If you don't know who Siegel is, it's Corky Siegel. And Corky has, I will tell you later in the show, it's like a multi-Corky Siegel October. He's performing Saturday, Sunday, next Saturday, next Sunday, Tuesday, a week from Tuesday, a week from Wednesday, and 2 weeks from Friday. I'll tell you where, but he is a Chicago treasure. You can add to that pile of treasures my new pal. We have crossed paths here and there, but thanks to our mutual friend Dennis Foley, Dennis is like turned into like an entrepreneur. He's a movie maker. He's a publisher. He's a writer. He's a Streets and Sand man.
He's a shaker, man.
Yeah, that is the voice of Patricia Ann McNair, otherwise known as Patty, whose collection of essays titled And These Are the Good Times is, to my mind, an astonishing read. It is honest. It is fun. It is insightful. It is very Chicago. Is that complimentary enough? What do you think? That's enough, Rick. I'm done.
I'm sort of verklempt over here. Done.
Well, don't be verklempt. It's a really honest gathering. And you had a previous collection, which I will soon be reading, of short stories. What's the difference? Many of these read to me, Patty, like a great short story. And that line, I think, sometimes between essay and short story can be pretty creatively thin, can it?
I think, yeah, absolutely. For me, story is at the heart of pretty much everything I write. And I think that that's essential to what I do, whether I'm doing nonfiction or fiction. Perhaps it's partly from my training. As you know, I went to Columbia College Chicago and trained
under the best, John Schultz, yeah, and Betty Shiflett and the great Randy Albers.
Right, story workshop method. So we were taught to look for this story and then see what you can find.
What you're a real Chicago kid. What drew you to Columbia and writing? When you went to Columbia, it was in the full flower of its writing prestige and joyful writing scene.
It was. And what drew me there, actually, I went to Columbia, believe it or not, to be a radio major. That was my original
intention.
That's
ridiculous. There's no money in this. That's crazy. There's no money in this. There's no creativity in this. It just beats people up and spits them out. What did you want to do on radio?
I wanted to just be a DJ or have a talk show or something. You know, I didn't quite know exactly what I wanted to do, but I really liked the whole... Back then, everything was really hands-on. I got to move discs and do all sorts of cool things. You know, it was before carts. And,
sure.
Because I'm old.
Sure.
So,
sure. What dissuaded you?
I knew that things were changing very quickly and that there were other people who were probably hungrier than I was to do it.
But was it, did you want to do it as a means of self-expression? I mean, to sort of you have a microphone in front of you. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah. I think to some extent it was that. I think probably part of what made me want to do radio is the same thing that made me ultimately know that I really wanted to be a writer. And I had been writing all along, but it was... kind of like to hear my own voice.
Yeah, yeah.
So I found myself I had to take a writing class at Columbia back in the day. There was a writing class component for the requirements, and I fell in love and didn't turn back.
And now you teach there.
And now I teach there.
You've been teaching there for some time.
For a long time.
I'm going to read. This is a collection of their essays. Can I call them, Betty, memoir-like essays, or if you had to, they're on all manner of different topics. I mean, a lot of it about your dad, we'll talk about his FBI file. A lot of it about you. You moved around a great deal in your life. It wasn't wanderlust as much as it was just curiosity. I get the feeling from reading this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've lived in Chicago and close to Chicago most of my life.
Right.
Right now I live about 2 miles from where I was born. And But I like to take trips. I like to go places. I went to Iowa for a while and lived there for a while, and I've had opportunities to teach overseas and different places. And I think that it's a little bit of a wanderlust thing.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Maine East.
Maine East.
Yep. Parkridge.
I'm just thinking there's some famous, who's the most famous writer to go to Maine East?
Most famous writer? Me, I think. No,
yeah, I think,
I don't,
yeah,
no,
let's
I'm
call
kidding.
It you.
But Harrison Ford went there.
That's right.
So, and other people.
Harrison Ford, who seems barely able to speak. Here is how Patricia Ann McNair, in her gathering of essays, And These Are the Good Times, captures a hot Chicago night. All right, those of you, I know I have a lot of, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Chicagoans here listening. Listen to this and tell me this doesn't ring so true. It was a kind of Chicago summer evening when the air hangs thick and unmoving and the sun takes its own sweet time going down. That kind of bright, hot, early night that you're grateful to get out of, even if it's to be inside a bar with no air conditioning. That's a great, great couple of sentences.
Thank you. It sounds great in your voice.
Well, you know, smoke and drink for all these years, you can do the best. You write a lot about, in the book, taverns and bars and jukeboxes. This first, the first of these essays, the title essay, And These Are the Good Times, is stunning. It's stunning and sensitive, and it's about your dad, and it's about life, and it's about death, and it's about jukeboxes, and it's about dancing. Taverns and bars are an important part, not only of this book, but of obviously then of your life. Do you see them as you know, Eugene O'Neill saw them as kind of a wonderful, you know, theatrical sets. There is something in them that lends itself to writing.
Yeah, there definitely is. It's a place where people tell stories. And so there's so much of that. You meet people and you tell them your story, or you listen to theirs. We used to have a house in Mount Carroll, Illinois,
mm-hmm.
and we'd go into the taverns there occasionally, and there would be an old farmer who wanted, you know, he'd ask who you were, and then he'd tell you that his dad was the first Baptist preacher in town, and you'd start to hear that story. And there's just something almost, there's something so comfortable in them, particularly the ones where the music isn't too loud, and the lights aren't too bright. And
well, I think it goes to the whole human need to communicate. I mean, you can't just, you can scream at a television set, but there are fewer and fewer places. You can't have long conversations in church. The places where people gather are not really conducive to conversation, except taverns.
Yeah, I agree. And again, you know, particularly the ones where you can hear one another speak, and that's the kind of bar and tavern that I particularly find attractive now. You know, there was a time when the bar where the music was loudest and you could dance the fastest was my favorite, but now I'd rather sit in a place where...
And people like to see you dance, too. You mentioned that in here. When you buy this book, And These Are the Good Times, you can buy it anywhere books are sold, and that means bookstores and online, or at Patricia Ann McNair. I'll spell it. Patricia is Patricia, Ann is A-N-N, and McNair is MCNAIR.com. You will learn a great deal about this writer, teacher. There's another stunning, before we take a break, there's another stunning essay in here called, titled, I Am Not Afraid, which includes this, if I can read this. Yeah. I am not afraid. Despite having been slipped a Valium in my drink at a club by a man I was seeing when I was 21 and living in a small, safe city in Iowa, a man who was staying with me and who I was having sex with already, and had intended to have sex with again that night when we got back to his house after the club, so why did he think he needed to drug me? I never did ask him. Why didn't I ask him? That's just an astonishingly honest paragraph. When you write something like that, a visceral memory has to come to you, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it disturbing?
I think that the way that this essay is written, they kind of come fast and furious. And I was literally just writing it in my journal just to sort of sort it all out. And, you know, it was right after, a year ago when the Bushy tapes came out.
Yeah.
So I just was sort of sorting through my own memories of these sorts of things. And I hadn't intended really for it to be an essay, but ultimately the piling on of it seemed like something that I wanted to tell to other people. So I initially published it on my own blog, and then Hypertext, which is a
fine magazine,
picked it up.
Yeah, I think it's just powerful. And These Are the Good Times is the title of the book, the long subtitle, and I love the way our mutual publisher friend of Side Street Press, Dennis Foley, does this. A Chicago Gal Riffs on Death, Sex, Life, Dancing, Writing, Wonder, Loneliness, Place, Family, Faith, Coffee, and the FBI, among other things.
I wouldn't quit you. I wouldn't quit you. I wouldn't quit you.
Gorky Siegel, everybody. I'll tell you where he's playing all this coming week. Bye. And These Are the Good Times by Patricia Ann McNair. Here's a bit of her philosophy from one of the essays. They're not long essays, but they're all to the point. And this is sort of out of context, but it's kind of a philosophy. She's looking at me like, huh, what? Death and sex and marriage and illness and marriage and death and love. Let's face it, that's about all there is. And some of us don't even get that much. That is so true. Truer words were never spoken.
Thank you.
Here you are on writing. One of the things I love about this book, Patty, is the forthright nature of your writing. I mean, you're a very honest writer. Do you feel that? Do you sense that? Is it hard to be that?
I don't think so. You know, when I first started to learn how to write, I didn't know any other way, right?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, we talked a little bit about journals, and I would never lie to my journal. And so when I would move forward from the journal to a story, it just seemed more interesting to follow the truth instead of or to just tell the truth as opposed to trying to make things seem better or more flowery.
And that's a lot of, too, the training one would get in the story method at Columbia.
Yes.
would lend itself to that kind of honesty. Here she is on writing. It is this moving from watching, gathering, storing away, to writing it down that changes things. What was real, what really happened, no longer matters, at least not to me. It is an interesting tension, this pull between observation and imagination, this balance of seeing it happen and making it happen, this place that is settled somewhere between what is real and what is imagined is where I come to do my work. This is where I live my storied life. That's pretty well put. I envy your students at Columbia if that is indeed the way you feel. Do you trust yourself? Do you trust your memory?
I don't.
Yeah,
yeah,
you can't.
I don't, yeah. I used to until I found myself so wrong on occasion that I thought, okay, I just have to go with it. This is the way I remember it. This is what I think happened. This is what more important to me is what I made of what happened.
Well, and also, but what you remember does indeed become your reality.
Yes.
I think it's true of everybody, whether they're writers or not. What you remember becomes your reality, and sometimes it makes it easier to live.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I have friends who are fiction writers, and they sometimes talk about how their memories now have gotten confused with their characters' memories, and I can totally understand that, too.
You've written short stories. Have you ever taken a stab at a novel?
I am working on a novel right now.
Are you?
Yeah.
What's it about, a dissipated radio jock who becomes a writer? Is it set in Chicago?
Yeah. No, actually, it's set in the same fictional small town as my story collection, mm-hmm. which is a place called New Hope. And it's called Climbing the House of God Hill, and it's about a scandal between a 15-year-old girl and her father's friend.
Oh, it sounds great. I'm going to have Patty read. I'm going to devote an entire show in November to having local writers read portions of their work, and Patricia Ann McNair is the first person selected to join this experiment in modern radio, and I'm glad you will, and you can read anything you want. One of the, before I let you go, one of the for me, the most haunting stories in here is about your brother. I won't tell you all about Roger, but Roger is damaged in certain ways. I'm not going to throw this off. But Patricia writes here at the end of the story, and you have to read the entire story to get it, but you'll get part of it here. I cannot smother my sorrow. I regret deeply many things. I did not walk over to the nursing facility when Roger did not answer his phone. I did not, when I could have, help him live. But mostly this. At the bar on Division Street, when we were both drunk, I told Roger to shut up, to quit making so much noise, to settle down, to keep still. He looked at me, chastised, hurt. His eyes filled. "I'm just trying to have a good time," he said. "Just trying to have some fun." And I regret deeply, with great sorrow, that I tried to stop him from that. Now, that's his emotion. That almost brings tears to my eyes. I didn't know Roger. I mean, that is a very, very... You're just a really powerful writer. What can I tell you? There are much lighter moments in the book. Believe me, this book covers a lot of territory in what is and has been a richly detailed life, Patricia Ann McNair. I am sorry I have not met you sooner. I am incredibly pleased to have met you now.
Well, I'm glad to have met you.
And you're the first person in what we'll call Kogan Voices, or whatever we're going to call this strange experiment in November. You can go to patriciaannmcnair.com. The title of you can find the book there, and her collection of short stories, which I ordered earlier today. The title of this book is "And These Are the Good Times." Patty, it's a pleasure to meet you. You're a great writer.
Rick, thank you, and thanks for putting your voice to my words.
My pleasure. You were born to write for me to read.
Thanks.
We'll be back after a couple. Once again, that's Corky Siegel, who in the next couple of weeks is performing all over town, and he is one of Chicago's great treasures. One of the other great treasures in this town, and I'm going to keep saying it until every single person in Chicago has visited it and says, when they are asked, "What's your favorite thing in Chicago?" answers, the Lurie Garden. I'm not going to say it's an undiscovered gem, but it is a gem that needs to be discovered by everyone here. Laura Ekasat, I knew I'd follow this up. Ekasetja.
Yeah, you got it.
That's close enough. She's the director of Lurie Garden. Am I right about this? I know that over the last few years, more and more people discover it, but it is still, Laura, really ripe for discovery, yes?
Yes. So you may have heard that Millennium Park, it's now verified, has over 20 million visitors a year.
Yeah.
So we're the number one tourist attraction of the Midwest, and we're in the top 10 of tourist attractions in North America.
Yeah,
so
I know.
It's a big...
All right,
how many of those...
How many of those 20 million will walk the modest number of steps to go inside what I think is one of the most fascinating gardens on this planet? Am I making too much of this?
Well, certainly I would agree with you on that. And I can only conjecture how many people really make their way to the garden, but it's certainly designed in a way that it can always feel peaceful and a relaxing place, even if the crowds become large in the surrounding areas.
You must know people who visit and hear from them really with some regularity, who may even visit it every day. Are there such people?
Oh, we have a number of regulars, yes. There's a lot of people who commute through the garden on their way to work. We have a gentleman who every day takes the same picture from the same spot. We have birders who come through regularly and keep lists of birds that stop in the garden. So, yeah, there are a number of people we see on a daily basis.
Remind me, because I thought your story was pretty fascinating. Did you start as just a volunteer there? Remind me of your background and how you came to be the director of that amazing place.
Well, I came to the public opening of Millennium Park, and I was amazed that you could interact with all the parts of Millennium Park, especially Laurie Garden. And I'm a fan of the designer of the garden. And so I certainly, you know, just stayed in touch with the staff. And when there was an opening, I moved on it.
Yeah, because your passion is palpable. There's no question about it. You one of the things we'll talk about after the break is the what I find an amazing number of programs I missed. And when is October 6th? That was like 2 days ago. The Morning Bird and Nature Walk. I missed that, right?
Yeah, and you would have, it was very successful. It was rainy that day, but somehow the rain held off during the walk. And so we did see a number of birds. Birds, you actually tend to see more birds when it's a little bit rainy. And during the migration, of course, it happens to be the fall migration. We're on the Mississippi Flyway, and we have a lot for the birds to eat. So they eat a lot of seeds, that the you know, a lot of the plants in the garden. We just let the flowers die and become a seed head, right? That's kind of the philosophy of the garden.
Yeah.
And so they get that, and then we have a lot of insects that they eat. So we had a great walk that morning. Jeff Walk led it, Director of Science for the Nature Conservancy. So we're in a great spot to partner with people like that for programs.
How are you? Millennium Park is this, as you said, this, you know, gathering place for 20 million people every year. How do you go about beyond? I know you don't stand out there and grab a family from Tokyo and drag them over to Lurie Garden and say, like, hey, look at this. But how do you get them? What's the pull? Programming is part of it. But sort of how else do you do that, Laura?
Well, we have a really active Facebook account and Instagram and our website. People can find us on our website. And sometimes they just see that and that piques their curiosity and they come.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, things like that really help out a lot.
What do you hear from people after they visited? I know that you are out there all the time. You have an office, I suppose, right? You got to have an office.
We have a secret office.
Secret office.
But I'm out in the garden every day.
Yes. Yeah, I knew you would.
Including today, just to make sure everything went fine with the marathon. It did. Yeah.
Did you get marathoners walking through?
Yes. Oh, everyone was out practicing for their run, even on Friday. Lots of people start to come into town then for the marathon. And so it's fun to see all these people like from all over the world coming through for this marathon.
Are they the look on their face sometimes like, where am I? I mean, it must be like, I mean, it is kind of in its way a wonderful secret garden, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really fun to see people that we're not expecting to come upon the garden. And they're like, what is? Sometimes they say things like, what is this? Or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And I once was weeding in the garden, and a little kid came into the garden with his parents. And there's a hedge of arborvitae trees. If you've been to the garden, you'll notice that it's surrounded on two sides by a 14-foot tall hedge of trees. And
which helps kind of make it secret, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of, it's like a visual and sound barrier a bit from the rest of the park. It kind of like, it draws in the rest of the park, I think, visually.
Yeah.
From like a broader landscape perspective. But when you're in there, it feels like a separate space. And I think the hedge helps that a lot. And it's narrow openings to get into the garden. And so this child thought he was walking into Narnia. He thought like he was walking through, you know, the closet into the forest and then out to the garden, because it's so much larger than you think the space would be once you go through it.
Fantastic. Oh, fantastic. And, you know, Ann Lurie, who is one of the most delightfully philanthropic, I spent some time at the Lurie Hospital, and it almost makes me wish I was an ill child. This is one of the most wonderfully philanthropic people I've ever met. Have you met her?
I have not met Ann Lurie. However, she has come through the garden. She's very not interested in a lot of attention.
She's very self-effacing, which makes her a great philanthropist. She doesn't, even though the name's on it, she's not tooting her own horn.
Oh, yeah. She's really not involved in that way. She's just really happy that someone's here taking care of the garden. And she's come through a few times and interacted with our volunteers who give docent tours. And yeah, she's a wonderful person.
Who is your boss? I'm curious, who is in charge? Is there...
There's an executive director of Millennium Park Foundation,
okay.
Which used to be Ed Euler's position, it's now Scott Stewart. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ed's great.
He is great. He is great.
He's still involved with the park.
Good. So you can just, are you basically, Laura, free to, I mean, obviously there are people you work with, and when you come up with the program that we're going to talk about in a few minutes after a short commercial break, is there some autonomy here? Do you get to really do this on your own? Or, you know, for instance, the Spring Bulbs Workshop, which takes place this coming Saturday, do you just say, hey, I think we should have a Spring Bulbs Workshop?
Yeah, that's pretty much what we do.
That's fabulous. That's great, because it's not burdened with the kind of nonsense bureaucracy of the rest of the city and the state, who would say, well, what do you mean by bulbs, and what do you mean by workshop, and what do you mean by this? I'm sure that's one of the reasons, because since you were on, I think it was about a year ago, or maybe it was earlier this year, maybe it was in the wintertime when I kept talking about the great thing about Lurie Garden is not to think of it as the garden in your backyard. This is a year-round facility. This is a garden that, although it doesn't have flowers in December, something is going on there.
Yes, right now is a good time to see the garden. We actually do have a number of things blooming. So there's
and it's
moving into fall color, so that's also nice. But you can come in the winter and it's still interesting. We're not going to cut the garden back until very early spring.
And do you decide what gets planted? You must work with what would they be called? Flower people, horticulturalists and people like that.
Well, the designer.
You're talking to a guy who grew up in the city surrounded by concrete his whole life.
Well, the designer of the garden, Pete Oldolf, who also did the Highline, he's very involved still. And the landscape architect firm, GGN, Gustafson, Guthrie & Nickel, they still help advise with the garden. And so we have good relationships with them.
This is great. It is, ladies and gentlemen, if you have never been there, you owe it to yourself to go there. It is as accessible as anything. You know where the Bean is? You know where the Bean is? You can find the Lurie Garden. And my suggestion would be to go there and just go to the Bean and just start walking southeast, and you'll find it. Are those good directions?
Those are perfect.
Yeah. It's so easy, but it does come on like a surprise. Lurie Ekasatya. What kind of name is that?
Indonesian.
Indonesian?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lovely name, Ekasetja. As the director of Lurie Garden, you can get more information at Lurie Garden. That's L-U-R-I-E garden.org. We will take a short commercial break, and we will come back and talk about more of the joys of this Chicago treasure. Siegel, everybody, and LurieGarden.org, everybody. Laura Ekasetja is in here. She's the director of Lurie Garden. She is passionate about Lurie Garden. I think her passion is palpable. It's fall now. I don't see the leaves turning, but I'm assuming they're going to start to look like fall one of these days. Yes.
Maybe later this week. Yeah. It looks like it'll cool off a bit. It's a little weird. Yeah.
But you have so many interesting, for you, obviously spring and summer are the big times at Lurie Garden, because spring is spring and summer is summer. But you have so many different wonderful kind. You have what is peace yoga that takes place on Saturdays there? What's that?
Yeah, the Peace School. There's actually a Peace School.
Yeah.
They come and they do a yoga class. It's a really great class, but it's not difficult. It's more of a meditation. So welcome anyone to come. Anyone can do this class.
The other thing, and I'm just saying, you can get all of this information at luriegarden.org, but I just want you to hear Laura's passion about it, too. You have a book club, and this book sounds fascinating, The Home Place, Memoirs of a Colored Man's Love Affair with Nature. That sounds like, just on the title, that sounds like a fascinating book. What have some been your other book club? See, it just, I think the wonderful thing expanding beyond, like, you know, learn how to plant a bulb or something is really wonderful. Yoga and a book club. Was a book club your idea? I suppose it was, Laura.
Well, the book club was my idea, but we have a program manager named Karen Tyra that helps come up with all these ideas as well. And she's really great. And so this book that we're doing next 2 weeks from now,
yeah,
right, is
October 24th.
Very beautiful, well-written book. I've really enjoyed it so far. I'm 2 chapters into it. And so we always want to pick books that we haven't read yet. And so that's our little secret criteria. They have to be about nature.
You guys are great. You're like your own little kingdom over there. That's what I like about it, without being bogged down by the bureaucratic nonsense that seems to afflict every other city organization. You also have a ton of family programs. Little Lurie Scientists is very intriguing to me. City Critters, what's that?
Karen Tyra came up with this idea of graduating Little Lurie Gardeners, which are toddlers that come for 6 weeks, so for once a week for 6 weeks, and they have a program that progresses each week where they learn songs and things like that about the plants in the garden. And then she wanted to find something for them once they got to be a little older so they could kind of progress to this next class, which is Little Lurie Scientist. And so those are very popular classes. In fact, they fill up really quickly. They're full, in fact.
Do you find that most of the people that come to the classes are city dwellers, or are they coming? I'll bet a lot are coming from the suburbs.
Yes, we get people from all over. We also, sometimes people come upon our classes, they find us on our website or on our social media accounts, and we'll get people that are from other states.
Wow.
And they'll come because they're in Chicago for some reason. And so I always love to meet people like that.
Well, the other great thing about this is all of these programs are free.
Yes. You
hear that, ladies and gentlemen? F-R-E-E, free. Another one that is, here's a very practical one. Never having had one as a child or as an adult, on December 10th from 1 to 3, family workshop, build a bird feeder. I have to think that it's not all that hard. I've seen them. I don't know how to build one. But that's another kind of thing that I just think would be an amazing kind of family activity.
It's a lot of fun, but it's a lot of hammering. That one's a noisy one. But it's a great class, and they get to build a really sturdy bird feeder. It's not just like take a pine cone and put peanut butter on it or something like that, which is also a good bird feeder.
Yeah, sure.
This is, you know, a bigger project. So
no, I'm not to get too personal, Laura, but where you live, do you have a garden in front or in back or on top of the place in which you live?
I have 2, actually. But I don't. But there's a lot of rules about them, so I'm not involved with them very much. When you talk about bureaucracy, so I live in a condo.
In a condo, and the people are not taking advantage of your incredible expertise. So the hell with them. You really get a lot of joy out of this job, don't you?
I do. I love this. I love Chicago, and I love working in this garden. It's so much fun. It's such a joy every day to see how things change. Not just through the seasons, but through the years.
Yeah. You are out in that garden every day.
Yes, yes.
Doing what?
Well, I have...
You work, and beyond sort of interacting. See, if I had your job, I would be a pain in the ass, because I would be asking every single person, what do you think? How do you like it? What do you think? You must do some of that, right? But you work too, right?
Yeah, I do such a variety of tasks, I suppose. Outside of, obviously, as a director, I do a lot of administrative things,
yeah,
and things like that, communicating and so forth. But I also help maintain the garden. And so I have staff that help me with that and volunteers, but someone needs to direct that. We recently won an award from Friends of Downtown for best continued use of a public space. And so we're excited to receive that award this Wednesday. And I think it's because people see us out there all the time.
I love the notion. I know a lot of people who will, on their way to work when the weather's nice, walk through a place like Lincoln Park Zoo, which is open and free to the public, on their way to and sometimes from work, because it is a calming kind of environment that removes them from the hustle and bustle. That's got to be, as you said at the start of this half hour, that's true at Lurie Garden too, that it is so peaceful that it is a way to, you know, it's like a a flowering psychiatrist couch or something.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to describe a garden. It's meant to be that way. It's meant to be the part of Millennium Park and the part of the area that is quiet. So right all around us are all kinds of events and fascinating music and cultural events and things like that.
Well, and, you know, and also, you know, strange urban people, too. I mean, that's what I get on Michigan Avenue. I mean, there's strange people all over this city. That's what one of the things that enriches the city, but it can get to it can be overwhelming. Before I let you go, this special event, Urban Wild, Celebrate Fall with Lurie Garden, it's on the Pritzker stage. What is this?
Yeah, so we're celebrating harvest in the city. So all of the vendors at this event are focusing on things that were grown or somehow produced in the city. We'll have popcorn grown in the city from City Farm. We're going to sell our honey. We've harvested all, I've lost track of how many pounds, somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 or 90 pounds we harvested. So we have that all jarred up and we'll sell that. We'll have other local beekeepers as well, because we, if you don't come early, we sell our honey out pretty quickly.
Yeah, I'll bet.
Goose Island made a really special brew for us. There's some ingredients from the city in that. Yeah, it's going to be really fun. So I really recommend coming. That's also when we give away our seeds. So I collect a lot of seed in the garden. And in fact, right now there's some more things that are becoming ripe that I need to get out there and collect this week. Because I think things are drying out a bit. You want to always collect when the weather's a little dry. And then we package those up and we give those away. Because all year long, people ask me about that. And they usually don't understand that the seed isn't ripe yet or something like that.
Right.
So I say, just come to our event and we'll have it.
Can you imagine yourself doing anything else in the world, Laura?
Not at this point in my life, no. Yeah. I really enjoy what I do, and every day is it's something different.
Yeah. Amazing. It's a different kind of bird or something flying in. I adore having you on this show, and I adore having you talk about what I think is just a, you know, this Herbs and Horto, the slogan of the city of Chicago. City in a garden, but this is the garden in the city. There's some nice gardens around, but Lurie Garden is without parallel.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Ray. What do you think I have? Do you think I would just have you on just to say, yeah, it's okay. It's just fine. I think you run a great place. Her name is Laura Ekasetya. She is the director of the Lurie Garden. You can get all sorts of information at luriegarden.org. If you had one of these fall events that you would say not, they're all cool, and you can, ladies and gentlemen, at luriegarden.org, pick and choose on your own. What are you most excited about? Which one are you personally most excited about?
Well, obviously I'm excited about Urban Wild because we've got all these seeds. I'm really excited to connect with all these people for that. But also Andy Pettis, who's the director of horticulture for the High Line, is coming to give a talk in November.
Oh, nice.
On Thursday. So check that out on our website. It requires registration, but it's free.
Yeah.
And I really like to hear, you know, what she experiences in New York. You know, we have the same designer, but we have completely different experiences.
Oh, it's complete. You've been to the High Line.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So that's, you've got narrow, it's beautiful, yeah. But narrow
oh, yeah.
planting, and then we're, you know, the field. So it's really, I'd love to hear her experience.
Laura, you're the best. Thank you. Thank you, too, for coming in. I'll see you soon.
Thanks for having
LurieGarden.org, LurieGarden.org, a short walk from right here, ladies and gentlemen.
Open every day.
Open every day. Never closes.
6 a.m. to 11 p.m.
Oh, it does close. 6 a.m. to 11. I think those, no, the zoo closes earlier. I think the zoo does open at 6. These are two, North Side and Downtown, these are two of the great places to remove yourself from the urban jungle in which we live and to find peace, at least for a little while. I will see you soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Flowers have grown over my head. That again is Corky Siegel. I'll give you all sorts of information about the many places that Chicago Legend is playing in the next couple of weeks. It is, I don't remember what day it was, one day last week, I'm at a book party for Jonathan Eich and his Ali book, and a nice man comes up and says, Rick, I'm Dean Jobe. And I said, oh my God, you're going to be on the radio. I would have put Dean on if he was even at home in Canada on the phone, having read his book, his most recent book, Empire of Deception, the incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated a nation. That city, ladies and gentlemen, is Chicago. That swindler is a man named Koretz. The author, Dean Jobe, how did you find this story when no local author seems to have ever, to my mind, come across it, and certainly did not think it worthy of book form, which it certainly is? And welcome to the show, and welcome to Chicago.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. I'm fortunate that the swindler, Leo Koretz, found me in a sense. I'm a former newspaper man, and now I'm a journalism professor in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And in 1923, when things get a little hot for Leo Koretz here in Chicago, he flees to Nova Scotia and lives there for a while under an assumed name, and I discovered the story that way.
Why Nova Scotia? There were other places, one in particular where he might have fled, Panama, for instance. Why do you think he chose, because it's a fortuitous thing for you that he chose this, why did he choose Nova Scotia?
Well, it was actually by chance. We're kind of ahead of the story, but when he flees Chicago, he ends up in New York and by chance meets a hunting and fishing guide from Nova Scotia who was working in New York for the winter. And he suggested this remote lodge that was for sale in Nova Scotia. And it seemed like just the thing Leo needed to lay low from the law.
Wow, Leo, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, this is one of my father, who was a great Chicago historian. I'm pretty sure he would have heard of this guy, but he would also have loved this book. When you first started digging into his life, did you know, we could get way ahead of ourselves and talk about the insane way he committed suicide before trial, which I do want to hit on, because that's one of the astonishing things that I've ever read. But when you started digging, you're a reporter, so you just start digging around this guy's life. It must have been one like holy cow after another for you, Dean.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I started from some of the Nova Scotia coverage, which brought me up to speed, and then started digging into the Trib and other Chicago newspapers. There were six dailies in the early 1920s, and just a treasure trove of material. I mean, if he made
good copy, this guy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, he was front page news for weeks because it was such a bizarre swindle. And so the papers pretty well interviewed almost everybody he'd known, and certainly many of the people he'd swindled, and the whole scenario that he convinced so many people he had oil fields in Panama when they didn't produce any oil in Panama, and got away with it for so many years that it was just, as you said, the revelations were amazing.
One of the intriguing things about this guy, and I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, this book, Empire of Deception, reads like Devil in the White City. It really does not have the big backdrop of the Columbian Exposition, but it has the backdrop of Chicago in the 20s, which is pretty amazing, and Panama and other places around the globe. This guy, to my mind, and now we'll go back to the beginning, is really such an unlikely, I'm not a psychiatrist, but such an unlikely master criminal, which is what he became. Talk about his early background.
Well, he was an immigrant from Bohemia, which is present-day Czech Republic, came here as a child, grew up in Northtown, Old Town.
Right.
And went to high school at a time most students didn't, or most young people didn't, and went through night school to become a lawyer. But the way my research seemed to suggest that he wasn't making the kind of money he wanted or expected, so he fell into what he said he fell into temptation. A client wanted to invest some money. He said, here's a mortgage. You should invest in this mortgage, except it was a fake mortgage on a non-existent property. And when he took some of that money and used some to pay interest, When he needed more money, he wrote another and another. He said he was writing them like he was writing up mortgages like streetcar transfers.
It's a kind of evil ambition fueled by, to my mind, and this book is so wonderfully detailed, fueled by some kind of envy of the wealthy people around him. Again, I'm trying to psychoanalyze the guy, and I'm beyond unqualified to do that.
Well, perhaps I am too, but I do think that he had grasped the American dream, or he wanted the American dream. But he started out so in such an ordinary fashion because, as I say, with these faked mortgages, he was really just trying to pay, rob Peter to pay Paul, and I think thinking he'd make good. But what he had stumbled on would become known as the Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
So he's taking capital, using it to pay investors, to pay interest, and constantly having to get new investors or suckers in the door so we can keep it all afloat. And it just snowballs over the course of almost 20 years.
One of the things I think, and you make the point here, one of the things that perhaps made him successful is he was a, what's the right phrase, a sort of nerdy milquetoast look. Milquetoast, that's an old, I haven't used that word perhaps ever, but that had to be one of the elements of that of his success, yes?
Well, he, as readers will find out, he's a notorious womanizer too, and he doesn't look
that
part.
Is hard, I know, it's sort of hard to believe, but.
He's an inspiration to all pudgy, bald men, I guess. But what he was incredibly charming, quick with a joke. Really, there's a lot of humor sprinkled in the book simply because he was such a funny guy and a self-deprecating humor. He'd make fun. He even almost taunted his investors. They started calling him our Ponzi, not realizing it was true, and he encouraged that. So, and the other thing he had is the attraction of money. I mean, he looked the part, and he had to look like a rich man.
He played the part. You've got the chapter 9, and I'm telling you again, ladies and gentlemen, The Empire of Deception by Dean Job. That's D-E-A-N. I insult you by even spelling it for you. Job, J-O-B-B. Dean also has a website, deanjob.com. Chapter 9, which is called The Sting, you write, Suite 629 of the Drake Hotel was the grand stage where Leo Koritz's grand scheme came to life. That's what you were just talking about. That is how it came to life. How did it come to life, Dean?
Well, he goes from mortgages to, of all things, Arkansas rice land, which was a legitimate investment. But then he starts watering stock and selling shares in companies he doesn't own there. It becomes a mini Ponzi scheme. And then he comes up, he discovers the idea of saying he has timberland in Panama near the canal zone and is profiting from that. And over time, people start clamoring, they're begging him to take their money because he's so successful as far as they can see.
But didn't he, and I'm trying to remember, I read the book a couple of weeks ago, he, at one point, he has a number of investors who think highly of him, and are making money off him and think he's really a smart guy. And then he goes away for a while saying that he's going to Panama to look at his land, or was it to buy something? Or remember?
When it all falls apart, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you're almost there, but I'll just take it to the next step. So
Sure. He's
doing well with his Panamanian timberland and getting a lot of investors. And he's got the big house in Evanston. He's got two Rolls-Royce limousines, and he's looking the part of this multimillionaire. When his Ponzi scheme starts to stall in the early 1920s, he discovers, and I've got air quotes on that, oil in Panama. By saying he's now got oil fields, there's even more of a rush of investors. And it all started getting out of hand. He was paying the amazing returns, 60% a
year. Right. Yeah.
And still, no one thought any different. I mean, we got to go back to the 1920s. This is the Roaring Twenties, the stock market bubble,
sure,
leading to the Great Crash. It was easy for him to do it. But you're saying what happens is he doesn't go away, but some of his investors are so excited they want to go to Panama.
Did they go themselves, or did they hire? Some of them hired like representatives to go down and see.
Well, about six of his key investors who were thinking they were actually going to become oil executives in his empire boarded a steamer in New York to head to Panama, and then Leo gathered what money he could and disappeared.
It is a fascinating story. Again, it's Empire of Deception, the incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated a nation. That city is Chicago. The man who tells that story, Dean Jobe, deanjobe.com is the website. We got to take a short commercial break. We'll come back here, and we will get to the most amazing suicide in history. But you do... And also, how you must have been, you obviously got so deeply attracted to the Chicago in the 20s and Chicago of the era. I mean, it comes alive in this book. Okay, later in the show, I will tell you the many places Corky Siegel will be playing in the coming weeks. But now my new buddy Dean Jobe and I are talking about the man who has obsessed me now. Your obsession, Dean, after writing Empire of Deception, has got to be not as intense as it once was. But the more you dug into the life of Leo Koritz and how he swindled some millionaires in Chicago out of not their life savings, you must have, in researching this book, I mean, you're dealing with this around, you know, a parallel line with the whole Bernie Madoff scandal and disaster. And even though the money is not the same, he makes Madoff look like a incompetent. I mean, and at least this guy, there's something. As bad as he was, there's something romantic about it, because he was at least imaginative. He was at least seeing forests of mahogany in Panama and seeing oil derricks coming up. I mean, that's part of the appeal.
Well, he did a prospectus in 1911, which launched it all, and he wrote about the jungles of the Bayano River in Panama, like he'd been there with a machete going through, and its prospects. And yeah, he could tell a good yarn. I call him the Bernie Madoff of the 1920s.
Yeah.
And I think it's apt, because only Madoff and Koritz, to my knowledge, from my research, have ever kept a Ponzi scheme going for almost two decades. Because you need that fresh money to keep it alive, to keep anyone from asking questions about why didn't I get my dividend or my interest.
Why do you think, let me ask you a question, and I know I can't even balance a checkbook, but why do you think he set those early returns for his first investors at 60%? That just seems, as we both made faces when you mentioned it before, that just seems so excessively high.
He started a little more modest. He started at 5 or 10, which was more in line. But at the end of it, after he said he discovered oil and when he really needed money, he was paying 60% a year. Now, people have asked me, why would he do that? Because it made it even harder for him, obviously, to meet his obligations.
Sure.
But Leo was such a great swindler. He had a lot of people who would take their profits and plow it back into more worthless shares, of course, taking the pressure off him. So he had a lot of people who were not taking the money out, but thought they were getting more of these shares. So that helped a bit.
You do such a remarkable portrait, paint him in such detail that I got to ask you, do you grudgingly at all respect this guy on any sort of level? You know him as, you must know this, Dean, you know him about as well as anybody except well, nobody, you know him better than anybody, I think.
And I was saying, we were saying at the break that, you know, it would be nice to talk to him, but I was just realizing, I don't think I could believe a word he said.
Yeah,
he did.
Yeah.
But people say, what do I think of him? And I always say, well, if you look beyond the lying and the cheating and the stealing and the womanizing and the absolute betrayal of everyone around him, his family, his friends, he was probably a fun guy to be around anyway,
yeah,
because he had the gift of gab, obviously. He's a tragic figure in one way because, as we were explaining earlier, he seemed to fall into this. At some point, he couldn't go back. He couldn't cover all the losses.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit of a tragedy, but you don't feel sorry for him, or you shouldn't, because he then realized he was really good at this, and he did play it for all it's worth.
Yeah.
Something on the order, in today's terms, $400 million flowed through his various Ponzi schemes over the years.
I am not the only person raving about this book. The Tribune has called it a masterpiece of narrative setup and vivid language. The New York Times Book Review, where it is hard to even get a book review, called it intoxicating and impressively researched. The Toronto Globe and Mail and the aforementioned Canada called it thrilling, too wild for fiction tale. And the Associated Press, this is a very interesting review of a book. A cautionary tale of 20s greed and excess reads like it could happen today. It does happen today.
I mean, that's right. And the Ponzi scheme. And one of the points I make is we talk about a Ponzi scheme now because in 1920, Charles Ponzi in Boston had a small run. Leo predated him by 15 years.
Right.
And unfortunately for poor Leo, got cheated out of having it called a Koritz scheme instead of a Ponzi scheme. As I said, he really upstaged anything that the real Ponzi did. And Ponzi schemes, yes, are sadly still with us.
Why do you think, Dean, before we get into in a couple minutes the strange suicide, why do you think that this story flew under the radar for such a long time until, you know, other people have mentioned it? J. Robert Nash has mentioned it, and it's been mentioned here and there, but when some young author or older author reads your book and says, oh, my God, I should have done that story, which many will, even historians, why do you think it was under the radar?
Well, it was many years ago that I discovered by chance his arrest in Halifax and found out about the story. There'd been no book then. Amazingly, that was over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So this was the first book. I think it was because, in the scheme of things, he was a flash in the pan. He did this for 20 years, but of course he didn't make any press. It was an avalanche of coverage when the scam was fell apart. And then after his eventual arrest in Nova Scotia, there's another avalanche of coverage. And otherwise, I think he just went off the radar.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's my gain, obviously, that this wonderful story was sitting there. But I think, I guess you could say in the 20s, attention spans were sometimes as short in ways as they've become today.
Yeah, and you know, maybe it has something, too, to do with, you know, followed by the Depression and a money story just didn't have the kind of legs that it should have had. He never went to trial, did he?
No, he didn't. Once he comes back, he pleads guilty. And actually waived extradition. There was a thought he might have been able to stay in Canada for months, but he decided he'd come back and face some music that he couldn't face before when the whole scheme collapsed.
And this whole suicide thing, I'm not spoiling, I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, I am not spoiling anything here. He doesn't go down and become the president of Panama and gives birth to, you know, Manuel Noriega's grandfather or something. He attempts suicide in he was diabetic.
Yeah.
And so was it his sister? Was it someone? He had someone. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you.
We could leave it as I think it's been called one of the most bizarre prison
suicides in history. I've called it the most bizarre suicide in history. My great and dear, dear friend, Karen Abbott, had this to say about Dean Jobe's book, Empire of Deception, the incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated a nation. Karen, of course, wrote Sin in the Second City. Her other book is Liars, Tempters, Soldier, Spy. She's a great writer, and she really knows Chicago. She knows history in Chicago. She calls this a rollicking tale that is one part The Sting, one part The Great Gatsby, and one part The Devil in the White City. That's also one of the great jacket quotes I've ever read in my life. I compared it to Devil in the White City. I forgot to mention Gatsby and The Sting. Dean, you can be really, really pleased just to have written a book this good.
Thank you.
Dean's website is deanjobb, deanjobb.com. The book, again, is Empire of Deception, The Incredible Story. Emphasis mine. Incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated the nation. I hope you've had fun in Chicago, and I hope you continue to have fun in Chicago.
I have, and I will. Thank you.
Flowers are grown over my head now.
That, again, is Corky Siegel. I'll give you all sorts of information about the many places that Chicago legend is playing in the next couple of weeks. It is, I don't remember what day it was, one day last week, I'm at a book party for Jonathan Eich and his Ali book, and a nice man comes up and says, Rick, I'm Dean Jobb. And I said, oh, my God, you're going to be on the radio. I would have put Dean on if he was even at home in Canada on the phone, having read his book, his most recent book, Empire of Deception, the incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated a nation. That city, ladies and gentlemen, is Chicago. That swindler is a man named Koretz. The author, Dean Jobb, how did you find this story when no local author seems to have ever, to my mind, come across it, and certainly did not think it worthy of book form, which it certainly is? And welcome to the show, and welcome to Chicago.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. I'm fortunate that the swindler, Leo Koretz, found me in a sense. I'm a former newspaperman, and now I'm a journalism professor in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And in 1923, when things get a little hot for Leo Koretz here in Chicago, he flees to Nova Scotia and lives there for a while under an assumed name, and I discovered the story that way.
Why Nova Scotia? There were other places, one in particular where he might have fled, Panama, for instance. Why do you think he chose, because it's a fortuitous thing for you that he chose this, why did he choose Nova Scotia?
Well, it was actually by chance. We're kind of ahead of the story, but when he flees Chicago, he ends up in New York and by chance meets a hunting and fishing guide from Nova Scotia who was working in New York for the winter. And he suggested this remote lodge that was for sale in Nova Scotia. And it seemed like just the thing Leo needed to lay low from the law.
Well, Leo, I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, this is one of my father, who was a great Chicago historian. I'm pretty sure he would have heard of this guy, but he would also have loved this book. When you first started digging into his life, did you know, I mean, we could get way ahead of ourselves and talk about the insane way he committed suicide before trial, which I do want to hit on, because that's one of the astonishing things that I've ever read. But when you started digging, you're a reporter, so you just start digging around this guy's life. It must have been one like holy cow after another for you, Dean.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I started from some of the Nova Scotia coverage, which brought me up to speed, and then started digging into the Trib and other Chicago newspapers. There were six dailies in the early 1920s, and just a treasure trove of material. I mean,
he made good copy, this guy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, he was front page news for weeks because it was such a bizarre swindle. And so the papers pretty well interviewed almost everybody he'd known, and certainly many of the people he'd swindled, and the whole scenario that he convinced so many people he had oil fields in Panama when they didn't produce any oil in Panama and got away with it for so many years that it just, it was this, like, as you said, it was just, the revelations were amazing.
One of the intriguing things about this guy, and I got to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, this book, Empire of Deception, reads like Devil in the White City. It really doesn't. It does not have the big backdrop of the Columbian Exposition, but it has the backdrop of Chicago in the 20s, which is pretty amazing, and Panama and other places around the globe. This guy, to my mind, and now we'll go back to the beginning, is really such an I'm not a psychiatrist, but such an unlikely master criminal, which is what he became. Talk about his early background.
Well, he was an immigrant from Bohemia, which is present-day Czech Republic. Came here as a child, grew up in Northtown, Old Town.
Right.
And went to high school at a time most students didn't, or most young people didn't, and went through night school to become a lawyer. But the way my research seemed to suggest that he wasn't making the kind of money he wanted or expected, so he fell into what he said he fell into temptation. A client wanted to invest some money. He said, "Here's a mortgage. You should invest in this mortgage," except it was a fake mortgage on a non-existent property. And when he took some of that money and used some to pay interest, when he needed more money, he wrote another and another. He said he was writing them like he was writing up mortgages like streetcar transfers.
It's a kind of evil ambition fueled by, to my mind, and this book is so wonderfully detailed, fueled by some kind of envy of the wealthy people around him. Again, I'm trying to psychoanalyze the guy, and I'm beyond unqualified to do that.
Well, perhaps I am too, but I do think that he had grasped the American dream, or he wanted the American dream. But he started out so in such an ordinary fashion because, as I say, with these faked mortgages, he was really just trying to pay, rob Peter to pay Paul, and I think thinking he'd make good. But what he had stumbled on would become known as the Ponzi scheme.
Yeah.
So he's taking capital, using it to pay investors, to pay interest, and constantly having to get new investors or suckers in the door so we can keep it all afloat. And it just snowballs over the course of almost 20 years.
One of the things I think, and you make the point here, one of the things that perhaps made him successful is he was a sort of nerdy milquetoast look. Milquetoast, that's an old, I haven't used that word perhaps ever, but that had to be one of the elements of his success, yes?
Well, he, as readers will find out, he's a notorious womanizer too, and he doesn't look
that
part.
Is hard, I know, that's sort of hard to believe, but.
He's an inspiration to all pudgy, bald men, I guess. But what he was incredibly charming, quick with a joke. Really, there's a lot of humor sprinkled in the book simply because he was such a funny guy and a self-deprecating humor. He'd make fun. He even almost taunted his investors. They started calling him our Ponzi, not realizing it was true, and he encouraged that. So, and the other thing he had is the attraction of money. I mean, he looked the part, and he had to. He had to look like a rich man.
He played the part. You've got the chapter 9, and I'm telling you again, ladies and gentlemen, The Empire of Deception by Dean Job. That's D-E-A-N. I insult you by even spelling it for you. Job, J-O-B-B. Dean also has a website, deanjob.com. Chapter 9, which is called The Sting, you write, Suite 629 of the Drake Hotel was the grand stage where Leo Koret's grand scheme came to life. That's what you were just talking about. That is how it came to life. How did it come to life, Dean?
Well, he goes from mortgages to, of all things, Arkansas rice land, which was a legitimate investment. But then he starts watering stock and selling shares in companies he doesn't own there. It becomes a mini Ponzi scheme. And then he comes up, he discovers the idea of saying he has timberland in Panama near the canal zone and is profiting from that. And over time, people start clamoring. They're begging him to take their money because he's so successful as far as they can see.
But wasn't he, didn't he, and I'm trying to remember, I read the book a couple of weeks ago, he, at one point, he has a number of investors who think highly of him and are making money off him and think he's really a smart guy. And then he goes away for a while saying that he's going to Panama to look at his land, or was it to buy something? Or remember
when it all falls apart, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, you're almost there, but I'll just take it to the next step. So
sure.
He's doing well with his Panamanian timberland and getting a lot of investors. And he's got the big house in Evanston. He's got two Rolls-Royce limousines, and he's looking the part of this multimillionaire. When his Ponzi scheme starts to stall in the early 1920s, he discovers, and I've got air quotes on that, oil in Panama. By saying he's now got oil fields, there's even more of a rush of investors. And it all started getting out of hand. He was paying the amazing returns, 60%
a
year.
Right. Yeah.
And still no one thought any different. I mean, we got to go back to the 1920s. This is the roaring 20s, the stock market bubble leading to the great crash. It was easy for him to do it. But you're saying what happens is he doesn't go away, but some of his investors are so excited they want to go to Panama.
Did they go themselves, or did they hire? Some of them hired like representatives to go down and see.
Well, about six of his key investors who were thinking they were actually going to become oil executives in his empire boarded a steamer in New York to head to Panama, and then Leo gathered what money he could and disappeared.
It is a fascinating story. Again, it's Empire of Deception, the incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated a nation. That city is Chicago. The man who tells that story, Dean Jobe, Dean Jobe with two B's, .com is the website. We got to take a short commercial break. We'll come back here, and we will get to the most amazing suicide in history. But you do... And also, how you must have been, you obviously got so deeply attracted to the Chicago in the 20s and Chicago of the era. I mean, it comes alive in this book. Okay, later in the show, I will tell you the many places Corky Siegel will be playing in the coming weeks. But now we're my new buddy Dean Jobe and I are talking about the man who is obsessed, me now. Your obsession, Dean, after writing Empire of Deception, has got to be not as intense as it what once was. But the more you dug into the life of Leo Koritz and how he swindled some millionaires in Chicago out of not their life savings, you must have, in researching this book, I mean, you're dealing with this around, you know, a parallel line with the whole Bernie Madoff scandal and disaster. And even though the money is not the same, he makes Madoff look like a incompetent. I mean, and at least this guy, there's something. As bad as he was, there's something romantic about it, because he was at least imaginative. He was at least seeing forests of mahogany in Panama and seeing oil derricks coming up. I mean, that's part of the appeal.
Well, he did a prospectus in 1911, which launched it all, and he wrote about the jungles of the Bayano River in Panama, like he'd been there with a machete going through, and its prospects. And yeah, he could tell a good yarn. I call him the Bernie Madoff of the 1920s.
Yeah.
And I think it's apt, because only Madoff and Koritz, to my knowledge, from my research, have ever kept a Ponzi scheme going for almost two decades. Because you need that fresh money to keep it alive, to keep anyone from asking questions about why didn't I get my dividend or my interest.
Why do you think, let me ask you a question, and I know I can't even balance a checkbook, but why do you think he set those early returns for his first investors at 60%? That just seems, as we both made faces when you mentioned it before, that just seems so excessively high.
He started a little more modest. He started at 5 or 10, which was more in line. But at the end of it, after he said he discovered oil and when he really needed money, he was paying 60% a year. Now, people have asked me, why would he do that? Because it made it even harder for him, obviously, to meet his obligations.
Sure.
But Leo was such a great swindler. He had a lot of people who would take their profits and plow it back into more worthless shares, of course, taking the pressure off him. So he had a lot of people who were not taking the money out, but thought they were getting more of these shares. So that helped a bit.
You do such a remarkable portrait, paint him in such detail that I got to ask you, do you grudgingly at all respect this guy on any sort of level? You know him as, you must know this, Dean, you know him about as well as anybody except. Well, nobody, you know him better than anybody, I think.
And I was saying, we were saying at the break that, you know, it would be nice to talk to him, but I was just realizing, I don't think I could believe a word he said.
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah.
But people say, what do I think of him? And I always say, well, if you look beyond the lying and the cheating and the stealing and the womanizing and the absolute betrayal of everyone around him, his family, his friends, he was probably a fun guy to be around anyway, because he had the gift of gab, obviously. He's a tragic figure in one way because, as we were explaining earlier, he seemed to fall into this. At some point, he couldn't go back. He couldn't cover all the losses.
Yeah.
And I think that's a bit of a tragedy, but you don't feel sorry for him, or you shouldn't, because he then realized he was really good at this, and he did play it for all it's worth.
Yeah.
And something on the order, in today's terms, $400 million flowed through his various Ponzi schemes over the years.
I am not the only person raving about this book. The Tribune has called it a masterpiece of narrative set up in vivid language. The New York Times book review, where it is hard to even get a book review, called it intoxicating and impressively researched. The Toronto Globe and Mail and the aforementioned Canada called it thrilling, too wild for fiction tale. And the Associated Press, this is a very interesting review of a book. A cautionary tale of 20s greed and excess reads like it could happen today. It does happen today.
That's right. And the Ponzi scheme. And one of the points I make is we talk about a Ponzi scheme now because in 1920, Charles Ponzi in Boston had a small run. Leo predated him by 15 years.
Right.
And unfortunately for poor Leo, got cheated out of having it called a Koritz scheme instead of a Ponzi scheme. As I said, he really upstaged anything that the real Ponzi did. And Ponzi schemes, yes, are sadly still with us.
Why do you think, Dean, before we get into in a couple minutes the strange suicide, why do you think that this story flew under the radar for such a long time until, you know, other people have mentioned it? J. Robert Nash has mentioned it, and it's been mentioned here and there. But when some young author or older author reads your book and says, oh, my God, I should have done that story, which many will, even historians, why do you think it was under the radar?
Well, it was many years ago that I discovered by chance his arrest in Halifax and found out about the story. There'd been no book then. Amazingly, that was over 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So this was the first book. I think it was because in the scheme of things, he was a flash in the pan. He did this for 20 years, but of course he didn't make any press. It was an avalanche of coverage when the scam was fell apart. And then after his eventual arrest in Nova Scotia, there's another avalanche of coverage. And otherwise, I think he just went off the radar.
Yeah. Interesting.
It's my gain, obviously, that this wonderful story was sitting there. But I think, I guess you could say in the 20s, attention spans were sometimes as short in ways as they've become today.
Yeah. And you know, maybe it has something, too, to do with, you know, followed by the Depression and a money story just didn't have the kind of legs that it should have had. He, he never went to trial, did he?
No, he didn't. Once he comes back, he pleads guilty and actually waived extradition. There was a thought he might have been able to stay in Canada for months, but he decided he'd come back and face the music that he couldn't face before when the whole scheme collapsed.
And this whole suicide thing, I'm not spoiling, I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, I am not spoiling anything here. He doesn't not go down and become the president of Panama. And gives birth to, you know, Manuel Noriega's grandfather or something. He attempts suicide in the strange, he was diabetic.
Yeah.
And so he... Was it his sister? Was it someone? He had someone. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell you.
Well, we could leave it as I think it's been called one of the most bizarre prison suicides
in history.
Yes,
I've called it the most bizarre suicide in history. My great and dear, dear friend, Karen Abbott, had this to say about Dean Jobe's book, Empire of Deception, the incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated a nation. Karen, of course, wrote Sin in the Second City. Her other book is Liars, Tempter, Soldier, Spy. She's a great writer, and she really knows Chicago. She knows history in Chicago. She calls this a rollicking tale that is one part The Sting, one part The Great Gatsby, and one part The Devil in the White City. That's also one of the great jacket quotes I've ever read in my life. I compared it to Devil in the White City. I forgot to mention Gatsby and The Sting. Dean, you can be really, really pleased just to have written a book this good.
Thank you.
Dean's website is deanjobe, deanjobb.com. The book, again, is Empire of Deception, The Incredible Story. Emphasis mine. Incredible story of a master swindler who seduced a city and captivated the nation. I hope you've had fun in Chicago, and I hope you continue to have fun in Chicago.
I have, and I will. Thank you.